tonight wanted to talk a bit, continuing on with our series on the basic ideas of Buddhism and how that affects practice, or how we can view that from the point of view of practice. Wanted to talk a bit about causality and what are known as the four marks of existence, or the four signs of existence, in this section of our book, Basic Buddhist Concepts by Kogen Mizuno. The reason I want to talk about causality relative to these four ideas is that, in a way, there's a way that we can attempt to take ideas out of Buddhism, out of practice, and out of the context of practice, and miss their significance, in a sense. And so one of the things about practice, one of the significant things about practice, is this idea of causality, that everything that arises has a cause, and the significance of that insight, not just what arises physically in the world, but what arises in terms of our minds, what arises in terms of our emotions, what arises in terms of our thought patterns, and what arises in terms of our ability to see the world clearly. All of these things have a cause. And, of course, the central question of Buddhist practice is, how do we address suffering? What do we do about suffering? And this isn't just an intellectual proposition. It's on the ground, in our actual life, how do we address suffering? What do we do with the suffering that arises in our minds and life? And what the Buddha is constantly bringing us back to is this idea of examining causality, examining the lines of causality, coming to understand what it is that we're doing, what that causes in our lives on all kinds of different levels. Causality is, without causality, without the idea of causality in the way that it's developed in Buddhism, practice is really gutted. It's really the power of practice and the significance of practice is really kind of, you know, neutered in a way. It's really the strength of it is removed, because and to say that practice doesn't lead to a transcendent state, an awakened state, as a causal effect, also guts practice. So when we're looking at abstract ideas that are of significance in Buddhism, it's really important to understand that that's the context that we're looking at it from, that everything has a cause, and that we can control or influence the effects that we receive in our lives. And that we're doing this as in order to find the cessation of suffering. We're doing this in order to understand how suffering works and how to get a handle on it, how to influence it, how to become more adept at dealing with it, and actually finding happiness within suffering. So the four marks of existence, and these, sometimes there are the three marks of existence in the Mahayana traditions, and particularly in the Zen tradition, we refer to them as the four marks of existence, the four signs of existence, are pretty much universally constant in whatever Buddhist practice you encounter. And you could say that the way that you can recognize whether or not a thing is Buddhist, whether or not a practice is Buddhist, is whether if it whether or not a teaching is Buddhist, is if it contains the four marks of existence. Okay. The four marks of existence are impermanence. Impermanence is a characteristic of all existence. Everything in the world is impermanent. Everything in the existence is impermanent. There is no persisting separate self in anything, and particularly in a human being. It's the second mark of existence. And the thing to emphasize with regard to that is the persistent quality. We are a self. We have boundaries. We have all the things that selves have in the Western world. The critical thing that we should understand is that that's not a solid thing that abides all through time. That the self itself is changing, and then it will eventually come to an end. It's impermanent as well. So there's no self. The third mark of existence, and when there's just three, then it would be awakening exists, or nirvana exists. There is, in other words, something beyond what we normally experience. And that also, that idea that nirvana exists conditions the first two. Impermanence is there, and no self is there, but that doesn't mean there's nothing. That doesn't mean there's annihilation or cold emptiness, because nirvana also exists. Another way you could say that is Buddha nature exists. And then the fourth mark of existence is that suffering exists as well. Now, these are, while they're characteristics of Buddhist practice, they're things that Buddhists talk about, all Buddhists talk about. They also have a universal quality to them, which is, they're not just things that you encounter if you wear the hat of a Buddhist. If you take off the hat of the Buddhist, these things actually exist anyway. If the whole kind of edifice of Buddhism were to wash away, impermanence, no self, suffering and enlightenment would still exist. So it's useful to understand that that's also true, and that we can prove that they're true. We can prove that they exist through the practice of meditation. I mean, as an ongoing practical matter, science is constantly coming up against the idea that everything is in motion, everything is impermanent. Even the laws of science say that. Shall I say that? Yeah. The laws of science are constantly evolving, changing. And of course, if we look closely at our own minds, we will see that the self that we are, there's both things happening. I'm still the same person that I was 25 years ago. And I'm really not that person anymore. Some things are the same, some things aren't the same. Actually, I might even go so far as to say nothing is really the same in some way. Although people who knew me 25 years ago and hadn't seen me between now and then would recognize me as the person that I was. So this is just my personal observation of myself. I can prove it true in a way. There is nothing in here that's really abiding as a persistent self. And at the same time, there is this continuity going on. The matter of suffering is something that we have to be careful about. As I say, in one sense, the whole project of Buddhism, the whole edifice of Buddhism, started out with that question of the Buddha. Why is there suffering? What's the mechanism of suffering? The Buddha is saying to himself, how do I understand this, and how do I help people and myself find something beyond suffering? How do I help people, myself, find an enduring mode of happiness, a way of life that is happy. And so it's not just a neutral sort of scientific observation. It's valued. There's something of value there. There's something, I mean, in one sense, we can sit in meditation and look at what arises in our minds, and we have to have the perspective of non-judgmentalism, where we don't decide about things. But, and we can see also that certain courses of action will cause suffering, and that part of us does not wish to cause suffering. So in that sense, there are values at play. There is morality at play. And that's something that's quite important to understand in terms of the background. Because again, as we're studying the matter of causality, as it applies to our own life, we're really asking ourselves, how do I create a life that doesn't suffer? How do I create an existence where I can get beyond suffering, where I can find something deeper than suffering? And as we're looking at our lives, if we look and we see, suffering is arising, I have not finished my aspiration yet to awaken. And that is it can be the source of, that can be the source of more suffering, you know, oh God, I haven't found the source, the cause of suffering yet. But it's also it can also be viewed in a positive way. Okay, I'm not done yet, and that means there is a deeper kind of experience that I can find still. I can still do something about the suffering that's arising in my mind. I can continue to train, even though I don't see what it is yet, what that I need to do. I can continue to go forward in training and meditation and understand more deeply how to understand my present suffering and transcend that. So to discover suffering in our life is not a bad thing, because it is the beginning of where we can find non-suffering, where we can find nirvana, basically. The word nirvana, by the way, means to cease. And there's a great dialogue between the Buddha and a Brahmin priest. And the Buddha is talking about the bliss of cessation, the bliss of nirvana. And the Brahmin priest is kind of saying, well, if everything ceased, then that doesn't sound very nice. That sounds kind of bleak and unpleasant. And the Buddha says to him, well, I say, I've been there, and I say it's blissful. You haven't been there, so go there and you'll find that it is blissful. And that's something to bear in mind as we go along. It's not that we, in terms of suffering, it's not that we ever are able to create a perfect world where we stop suffering. That's not what the Buddha is helping us to find. The Buddha is helping us to find a deeper experience of life which is free from suffering, which is free from what is arising in our minds, which is liberated. We, in one sense, practice is all about changing our perspective on what's going on in our own minds and hearts. By the process of sitting down and doing meditation, we're effectively strengthening our ability to, we're strengthening our mind, we're strengthening our ability to see clearly, we're clarifying our ability to see clearly. And we're changing, in that sense, we're changing our perspective on what's going on in our minds. We're seeing it a little more clearly. And when we do that, something quite interesting happens. I was noticing recently and talking to someone recently about the idea that we have, that we mention sometimes about where if you encounter an idea in Buddhism that doesn't really kind of make any sense to you, or doesn't really work, or you don't like it, You can just set it on the back burner. You don't have to believe it. You don't have to disbelieve it. And this idea of setting it on the back burner is analogous to something that arises as a result of meditation, which Kazon describes as, he says in his How to Do Pure Meditation, he says, no need to activate body, no need to activate mind. In terms of meditation, it's been my experience that there are times when I can just sit still and I don't, and something can be going on and I don't have to decide one way or the other about that thing. It's just there. It's arising and passing away. I don't have to embrace it. I don't have to do anything with it. I can just allow it to arise and pass away. And I don't have to understand it. I don't have to do anything. I'm just sitting there and my mind is not activated in that sense. I mean, there's some stuff going on in there, but that quality of evaluation is not activated. And that in itself is a great liberation. There are just so many situations where that's kind of really handy, like dealing with people, you know. Is this person trying to mess with me or what? I don't have to decide whether they're trying to mess with me or not. I can just sit still and allow whatever's going on to pass through in a way. And then do what I need to do. Do what's good to do. Without, in one sense, activating the upset about it, whatever's going on or whatever. So there's liberation in there. And there's also a clearer view of seeing. There's, in one sense, great space. One of the things that we're doing when we engage in practice on the level of causality is that we're studying it. We're studying how causality works in our own mind. We're studying how impermanence works in our own mind. We're studying how no self works in our own mind. Studying how suffering works, and studying how awakening works. We're studying these things, we're coming to understand them better. But more profoundly, what we're doing is actually changing causality in that act. We're actually doing something different. We're actually doing enlightenment. When we're doing meditation, we're doing enlightenment. We're doing practice. And in that doing, that's the doing of something different. In a way, you could say, it's a little bit oversimplified, but we could say, the suffering that I experience in the here and now is the result of my doing something from a mistaken point of view, is the result of my doing. And by engaging in practice, what we're doing effectively is doing something, doing the thing different that creates suffering. I don't know if that makes any sense. On a fundamental level, when we engage in meditation, we're doing the thing fundamentally, which will lead to non-suffering. So we're doing the different thing than the thing which we did before, which obscured our vision. And it's very hard to communicate that to people when in the beginning. Well, it's very hard to communicate it to me. Not in the beginning. And for people to begin to have faith in that. Because it is, in a sense, an act of faith. Somebody like me comes along and says, well, just do Zazen. Do everything from the mind of Zazen. And you're like, all right, what do you know? And quite reasonably, I think. And so then we say, okay, well, give it a try. And you give it a try, and something's a little different when you sit. And as you continue to sit, something's continuing to be a little different. And part of that little different thing is not just the individual choices that you're making that are different on a conscious level, but part of the difference arises from the sitting itself, from that doing of something different. And that cannot be underestimated. The sitting itself really is changing the direction of our life. Even if you have no idea what I'm talking about on a conceptual level, if you have no interest in what I'm talking about on a conceptual level, and except to say I'm interested in meditation and I'm willing to do meditation, then that's great. I mean, that's the critical thing. I think my point is, even if you have no concept about it, we can still engage in meditation and still have a radical shift in our perspective, still have a radical shift of direction in our life. And that direction will lead to awakening. That direction will lead to nirvana. Nirvana exists. The Buddhas and ancestors don't lie. They're not making anything up. Or not making that up. They probably make something up. So causality, then, is right at the heart of practice and is something we all want to the extent that we can, look into, come to understand more clearly, begin to see in our own life. Reverend Master Jiyu said, the cause of suffering is a very subtle matter, and we must go through our minds and hearts, back and forth, sifting, in ever more subtle ways. So, and it just takes as long as it takes for us to be able to begin to see how it works for us on deeper and deeper levels. Causality, then, is right at the center of our practice. So I think that's what I want to say this evening. Do you have any questions about that?
The lack of a permanent abiding self covers everything, right? Not just people or other sentient beings, but everything.
Yeah. Yeah, it covers everything. For all the way from the gods down to the atoms, to the particles, the fundamental atomic particles. Nothing has a permanent abiding self. And this is, in a way, it's quite significant. The Buddha actually said, and I've said this before, we talk about creating good karma, we talk about creating merit, doing acts which create merit, making offerings, building temples, doing things which create merit. And the Buddha said, taking all of those things and adding them up, all those kind of positive actions and adding them up, does not equal the amount of merit that arises from the contemplation of impermanence. The no separate self is taking the contemplation of impermanence and looking at our own mind and beginning to see, examining in our bodies and mind, there is no self in there. Even though there's a psychophysical convenience that we call Leon, there is no self in there. And when you begin to understand that about yourself, then it becomes apparent that there isn't a self in anything else. It's just because you see that you are indivisible with existence. In that respect, and it's a little disturbing, there is nothing guiding us. There isn't any kind of supposed to about our life. There isn't any kind of overarching plan. There's just cause and effect, and the five laws of existence. And so we are pretty, you know, the level of impermanence is profound and completely penetrates the whole universe. And can take you a long way if you're willing to really look at that.
So is nirvana impermanent also?
Is nirvana impermanent?
Or is that one of those questions the Buddha didn't answer?
Yeah, I think it's probably one of those questions. Did he answer that question? I don't know of a time when he gave an answer to that question. I don't also know I don't know of a time when he said, I'm not going to answer that question. Mm-hmm. What awakening does is help us to see, understand causality and be in control of it, to be in charge of it. Awakening, becoming an arahant, the teaching tells us how to cease from creating future suffering for ourselves. It doesn't stop the fruition of past karma from arising, but it shows us how to cut our creation of future suffering. And we'll talk about that specifically in the next talk. We'll talk about dependent origination. And that is the process by which the self, our delusive self, is created. That is the process by which we bind ourselves to suffering. It doesn't... And so then, just to further the question, further answer the question you have had, if you know how to not create future suffering and you are committed to that, then in that respect, nirvana is abiding and permanent because you're not no longer creating suffering for yourself. It's possible, theoretically, that you could rebind yourself to suffering, and in that respect, your experience of nirvana would come to an end. I suppose, theoretically, it's possible. You know, one of the ways they describe the Buddha is that he will never be reborn again as a human being. And that means he will never be reborn again as anything. That implies that it's just not going to happen that he creates more suffering, binds himself to the wheel of samsara again. But I suppose theoretically he could, if he wanted to, but he wouldn't really want to, for some example. And there's a quality of it which I can only say, let us go there and find out, because I can't really tell you because I'm not there. Mm-hmm. But let us go there and find out. Yes.
I think I might be struggling with the word control.
Yeah.
I could understand mitigate, maybe influence, but control, for some reason, I don't know. Seems a little prickly.
Tell me, control. I know I used the word, but remind me of
cause and effect, control effect, I guess. Right.
Okay. Yeah, I know. I like that word for some reason, but I know that other people aren't really that keen on that word. And what I mean by it is really not controlling the outcome of events, controlling our choice of acting on greed, hate, and delusion, or out of enlightenment, compassion, love, and wisdom. And it's really controlling, when I'm talking about controlling, I'm saying the input that we have into the choices that we make.
It's a lot like acceptance.
Yes.
It's not necessarily what you may have formally had wanted. But it is what it is, and then you bow to it.
Yeah. What do you mean by formerly had wanted?
Well, when you think control, you think, this thing's coming up, I'm going to control the outcome. That's not...
Right.
That's not what...
No, that's not what I mean by that.
Right.
Let's see if I can think of a better word for it. Well, we could also talk about it in terms of restraining greed, hate, and delusion, or actions on greed, hate, and delusion. Suffering, of course, arises when we act on greed, hate, and delusion. And when we are unable to let those things go. And so if we can understand and train our ability to keep from acting on greed, hate, and delusion, then in that respect, we will have created the conditions for enlightenment to arise. We won't be able to necessarily control all outcomes, but we will be able to do what is productive of awakened action. Yeah, I have to be really quite careful about trying to control existence. And there is a quality in our acceptance of life. There is a quality of it where we understand that the reason that we're practicing acceptance is from that value place, from that place of values, where we're saying, I'm practicing acceptance because, well, ultimately because that's what Buddha nature does, but also on a more kind of functional level because that's what's productive of non-suffering. That's how I get there. That's how I get to the place of acceptance. And when I'm in the place of acceptance, then I can more effectively respond to circumstances from this, again, place of value, place of wanting to help beings to not suffer, and can take action which helps beings to not suffer. So it's not a neutral acceptance. It has that other positive quality to it. But it recognizes that from the place of acceptance, that's where I can be most effective, and that's the place that is in harmony with Buddha nature, with what's real. Does that make sense? Anything else?
It isn't the first time I've heard you and other, I think Rinpoche's on too, say that suffering arises when you act out of greed, hate, and delusion. But I can imagine a lot of scenarios where suffering arises even when you're acting out of very altruistic motives. Like people that get maimed or die trying to save other people from a horrendous accident or whatever.
Yes.
So that seems to be a little... Is the suffering mitigated in some way, or am I thinking of suffering incorrectly? Like, maybe, you know, I think of dying as suffering, but perhaps, but to avoid that, just say, okay, you know, you get badly burned, or rescuing someone from a fire or something.
Everything has a consequence to it. And there is shall we say, there are different degrees, different facets of suffering. the kind of, sometimes I've heard teachers make a distinction between suffering, the mental anguish of not getting what we want, being separated from loved ones, having to be around people who we don't like, that kind of mental suffering, and physical pain. And that can be a useful and illuminating way of thinking about it. But I think more and more I think of it as all a bit of a piece, and look at my life not just in specific terms, how do I keep specific suffering from arising, but understand that coming into life as a human being, I accept a fair level of general suffering, which arose from the taking on a human form, however that happened. And so it's attendant on the kind of coarse consequence of being a human being. So then what that does is say that kind of question then is still significant, but it kind of focuses my mind in a more subtle way at what's going on in my mind. And to look for the level of upset, the level of mental anguish and sadness and regret. So I can put myself into a situation where I'm going to get killed. And that has its own suffering about it. But there is there are layers of extra suffering that I can add to that because of my attachment and the way that I deal with my own mind. So I can put myself into a situation where I have to rescue somebody and I'm going to get killed, and it's playing through my mind. Oh God, I haven't got the Samsung Galaxy 3 smartphone yet, and I really wanted that, and I'm going to miss it now that I'm dead, and I'm bummed about that. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And that's a level of suffering that I've added on to just the basic kind of nuts and bolts suffering of dying. And from what I've seen, dying is physically just not a pleasant process, and probably mentally it's not a pleasant process for most people. So what we have to do is be willing to get in there and look closely at what's going on in our minds, and be kind of, in a way, brutally honest with ourselves about what's going on and what the layers of suffering that we're adding to our minds are. And is my suffering arising because I, can't get my ice cream, or because I, let's see if I can come up with a more realistic example here. Well, someone passes away that we're close to. Is my suffering, and it may be that if we could realize a state of an awakening and enlightenment where we didn't have any grief arising when someone passed away. But it may also be that grief arising when someone passes away is just part of the kind of background connections that we have with people, and just as a naturally attendant thing. I've seen different arahants will claim different things about their grief. So is it just a naturally arising grief from the passing away of someone close to us? Or am I attached to that person? And is the grief of the separation arising because of attachment? And in one sense, it's not critical to answer that question in a specific terms. It's more of a matter of being willing to sit still in the arising and see it clearly for what it is, and be willing to see it clearly for what it is, and to work on letting go of whatever kind of grief it is that's arising. And from that place of sitting still and being willing to see clearly and being willing to let go, then we might get some insight on it, why I was clinging to that person or why I was pushing that person away or that sort of thing. And in that way, we, whatever the situation is, whether it arises from some kind of selfishness or whether it arises from non-selfishness, we're training within it and looking at it and learning from it. And one of the things, again, that we're giving expression to then by doing that is what the Buddha called unconditional liberation of mind. It's the non-liberation of mind is when we won't look at it, where we won't sit still with it, and that binds us to it. We're not willing to let it go, where we're not willing to look clearly, see what's going on, sit still in it, accept whatever it is. When we do that, then we're going into it with open hands and open heart and allowing it to arise and pass away. And that's what we mean by liberation from it. But if we're clinging on to it and not being willing to let it go, not being willing to look at it, see clearly, then we're binding ourselves to it. That's what we mean by non-liberation. That's what we mean in a sense by the suffering of suffering. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Anything else? Okay, well, thank you very much for your patience.